respect accorded an older brother. Neither his physical stature nor his age, however, could compensate for his lengthy absence abroad throughout the great constitutional reforms of the late 1780s. Madison had kept him apprised of the debates at the Constitutional Convention. No better source existed on the planet. And Madison had also beaten down the rumors circulating in the Virginia Ratifying Convention that Jefferson was at best lukewarm on the constitutional settlement itself. The rumors were in fact true, though on all constitutional questions Jefferson deferred to Madison's superior judgment so he could accept the offer to become America's first Secretary of State without political reservations. It also helped that foreign policy was the one area where he believed the nation should speak with one voice. Beyond that elemental level, his views on federal power were unknown, in part because he had not been involved in the great debates of 1787 to 1788, and in part because his own mind did not operate at Madisonian levels of specificity and legalistic clarity. "I am not a Federalist," he declared in 1789, "because I never submitted the whole system of my opinions to the creed of any party of men whatever. If I could not go to heaven but with a party, I would not go there at all." The temporary capital in New York was hardly heaven, but he had agreed to go there in the spring of 1790 with his allegiances undeclared and his own lofty political principles uncontaminated by the kind of infighting that Madison and Hamilton had perfected to an art. He had come reluctantly. This was part of a lifelong pattern of reticence, dating back to the pre-revolutionary years in Virginia, when he had first emerged from the mists of the Blue Ridge Mountains to attend William and Mary, study law with George Wythe, and win marginal acceptance by the Tidewater elite. He gained his reputation as an effective writer against British encroachments, but was a reclusive non-presence in debates. In the Continental Congress, John Adams had described him as a staunch advocate of independence who never uttered more than two or three sentences, even in committees. His lasting fame, indeed immortality, derived from his authorship of the Declaration of Independence in June of 1776, but few Americans knew about that role in 1790. The Declaration was still regarded as a product of the whole Continental Congress, not the work of one man, and had yet to achieve the symbolic significance it would in the 19th century. His service as wartime governor of Virginia had ended disastrously when British troops burned the capital as Jefferson galloped off and into official disgrace. Though later cleared of any wrongdoing, he vowed never to accept public office again. The hurly-burly of politics did not suit his temperament, which was only comfortable when ensconced on his mountaintop and redesigning his mansion at Monticello. Always poised for retirement, he had accepted the diplomatic post in Paris to escape the painful memories of his wife's premature death in childbirth, had performed his duties ably, and had even gained a semblance of fame in France as Franklin's successor as the Gallic embodiment of the archetypal American in Paris. His protestations, when offered a position in the new government in 1789, were utterly sincere, but Madison had been his usually persuasive self, and more to the point, America's only indispensable figure, had suggested that Jefferson was also indispensable. One did not turn down George Washington. The dinner invitation he had extended to the embattled Madison and Hamilton was perfectly in keeping with his character. Put simply, Jefferson could not abide personal conflict. One of the reasons he was so notoriously ineffective in debate was that argument itself offended him. The voices he heard inside himself were all harmonious and agreeable, reliable expressions of the providentially aligned universal laws that governed the world as he knew it, so that argument struck him as dissonant noise that defied the natural order of things. Madison, who knew him better than any man alive, fully realized that there was an invisible line somewhere in Jefferson's mind above which lay his most cherished personal and political ideals. Cross that line, and you set off explosions and torrents of unbridled anger of the sort that got spewed at George III in the Declaration of Independence. Jefferson did not regard such occasions as arguments, but rather as holy wars to the death. But short of that line, he was endlessly polite and accommodating, genuinely pained at the presence of partisan politics. This was clearly his posture in June of 1790. There were also practical reasons why he wanted to broker a compromise. As a former foreign minister, now serving as Secretary of State, Jefferson required no instruction on the international implications of America's debtor status. Until her foreign debts were paid and her credit with the Dutch bankers in Amsterdam restored, the United States would simply not be taken seriously in Europe's capitals. Jefferson had learned this the hard way during his Paris phase. He, therefore, felt even more sharply than Madison that the fiscal goals of Hamilton's plan were absolutely essential. Without credit, the new nation would remain a laughingstock in foreign eyes, and therefore, when those same frenzied Virginians who were writing Madison about the fatal curse of assumption also wrote him, he was even less supportive, though characteristically elusive. It appears to me one of those questions which present great inconveniences whichever way it is decided, he wrote his new son-in-law. Or when Henry Lee flooded him with apocalyptic premonitions if assumption were to pass, he counseled patience and greater trust in the wisdom of Congress. In the meanwhile, he observed rather elliptically, the voice of the nation will perhaps be heard. While vague, the intended effect of the Jeffersonian message was to calm his fellow Virginians. My duties prevent me from mingling in these questions, he explained to George Mason just a week before the dinner. I do not pretend to be very competent to their decision. In general, I think it necessary to give as well as take in a government like ours. The giving and the taking on the location of the permanent national capital had been positively fierce ever since the question had come before Congress in September of 1789. The Constitution had provided for Congress to identify a seat of government not to exceed 100 square miles in size to be purchased from the proximate states. The question was, where? From the start, the prospect of congressional representatives reaching an easy consensus on the location was problematic at best. One newspaper editor had sagely, if cynically, observed that the usual custom is for the capital of new empires to be selected by the whim or caprice of a despot. While this was obviously not the Republican way, perhaps an exception was justified, since George Washington, as the editor observed, has never given bad advice to his country, did it not make practical sense to let him point to a map and say, here? What became known as the residency question was a logistic nightmare. All the regional voting blocks, New England, the Middle Atlantic, and the South, could cite plausible reasons for claiming primacy. And each of the 12 states, Rhode Island did not show up in the Congress until June of 1790, could imagine schemes whereby the capital fell within its borders, or the support for another location promised collateral benefits to be negotiated at a price. The crisscrossing patterns of regional and state bargaining were further complicated by two political considerations almost guaranteed to preclude consensus. First, legislation had to pass both the Senate and the House, So, as soon as an apparently victorious option made its way through one branch of the Congress, the opposition mobilized against it in the other. Second, early on, a decision was made to choose a temporary location which would serve as the capital for 10 to 20 years, then a permanent location which would presumably require the extra time to ready itself for the federal occupation. This distinction played havoc with congressional debate by creating doubt that the temporary location once chosen would ever be abandoned. As a result, by the time Jefferson had arrived in New York in March, 16 possible sites had been proposed but had failed to muster a majority. The leading candidates in alphabetical order were Annapolis, Baltimore, Carlisle, Frederick, Germantown, New York, Philadelphia, the Potomac, the Susquehanna, and Trenton. Given its geographic centrality, some location in Pennsylvania appeared to have the edge. "The business of the seat of government is becoming a labyrinth," Madison reported back to a fellow Virginian, "for which the votes printed furnish no clue, and which it is impossible in a letter to explain to you." The political wheeling and dealing inside the Congress and out had reached such epidemic proportions that Madison was given the unofficial title Big Knife for cutting deals. If the Big Knife would give up Potomac, the matter would be easily settled, one Pennsylvania man reported to Jefferson. "But that, you will say, is as unreasonable as it would be to expect a Pennsylvanian to surrender at discretion to New York. It therefore amuses me to see the arguments our grave politicians bring forward when I know it will be determined by local interests." While the Virginians were not accustomed to thinking of their interests as merely local, by the eve of the dinner at Jefferson's, the prospects for a Potomac site had faded, and Madison's formidable skills as a political negotiator had assumed a wholly defensive posture, coordinating opposition to a Pennsylvania victory. The case Madison had tried to make for the Potomac was simultaneously crafty and driven by romantic illusions about its prowess that were shared by Jefferson, Washington, and most members of the Virginia dynasty. In the crafty vein, Madison was ingenious at contesting the strongest argument for a Pennsylvania location, which was its geographic centrality. The Pennsylvanians were not devoid of craft either, arguing that the Susquehanna River was destined to become the center of the United States because the Trans-Mississippi West would never enter the Union and eastern Canada almost surely would. Madison countered that centrality could be measured demographically as well as geographically, so they should await the results of the census of 1790 before deciding. Then he argued that a purely geographic measure on a north-south axis revealed that the exact midpoint between northern Maine and southern Georgia was not just the Potomac, it was Washington's estate at Mount Vernon, a revelation calculated to carry providential overtones. The more romantic case for the Potomac entered the debate during Madison's initial speech against the Susquehanna site. He seemed to argue, contrary to common sense and the visual evidence provided by all maps, that the Potomac was actually farther west than the Susquehanna. What he seemed to mean was that the upper reaches of the Potomac near the Maryland-Pennsylvania border, where the Conococheague Creek emptied into the Potomac, was nearly as far west as the Susquehanna, and here was the grand Virginian illusion, afforded the only direct water route to the Ohio Valley and through its river system to the Mississippi itself. The mention of Conococheague Creek provoked waves of sarcasm from incredulous congressmen. "Enquiries will be made," observed one Massachusetts member. "Where, in the name of common sense, is Conococheague?" And he might have added, "How does one spell it?" The consensus outside Virginia seemed to be that not one person in 1,000 in the United States knows that there is such a place on earth, and those few who did were all Indians. Madison's preferred location for the national capital was a wigwam place suitable for hunting parties and hermits. While Madison was probably stretching the truth for his Potomac-driven political purposes, it was nevertheless a truth that he and many Virginians sincerely believed. For nearly a decade, Jefferson and Washington had corresponded about making navigation improvements in the Potomac on the presumption that it afforded a direct link between the vast American interior and the Chesapeake Bay. The misconception drew its inspiration from the same combination of soaring hope and geographic ignorance that subsequently led Jefferson to believe that the Lewis and Clark expedition would discover a water route across the North American continent where none existed. One could trace the illusory properties of the Potomac's waters all the way back to John Smith, who first explored the mouth of what the Algonquin Indians had named Potomac, meaning trading place, in 1608. For Virginians of the Revolutionary generation, the myth of the Potomac probably derived its credibility from the colonial era, when the lack of any border to Virginia's western provinces, theoretically and legally, Virginia extended to either the Mississippi or the Pacific Ocean, caused a habit of mind to develop within the Old Dominion that it was America's gateway to the West. Once established, the myth developed a rather hilarious life of its own to include publications like Potomac Magazine, in which the Potomac was described as the Thames, the Seine, and the Rhine rolled into one, and the confluence of the Potomac and the Anacostia was thought the world's most perfect harbor, where 10,000 ships the size of Noah's Ark could comfortably dock. Unfortunately for Madison, the Potomac mythology was largely confined to Virginians. Fisher Ames of Massachusetts spoke for those congressmen denied the vision when he said that the customarily sensible Madison had obviously come under some biblical spell and had confused the Potomac with a Euphrates flowing through paradise. The Virginians were certainly free to dream their provincial Potomac dreams, but meanwhile the Congress should proceed to the serious business of selecting a national capital located in this world rather than in Madison's imagination. By June of 1790, Madison himself had just about given up hope. "If any arrangement should be made that will answer our wishes," he confessed, "it will be the effect of a coincidence of causes as fortuitous as it will be propitious." And this, of course, is where the fortuitous prospect of a bargain entered the picture. We cannot know how many secret meetings and political dinners occurred in New York during the late spring and early summer of 1790. We do know that Jefferson's famous dinner was not, as he implied, the only such occasion. First, Hamilton's chief assistant in the Treasury Department, Tench Cox, met with Jefferson and Madison on June 6th, presumably to discuss Virginia's debt and the impact of assumption on the state's balance of payments to the federal government. Second, around the same time, Hamilton met with members of the Pennsylvania delegation to negotiate a trade of their support for assumption, Hamilton's overwhelming priority, in return for the location of both the temporary and permanent capital in their state, a trade that never materialized because Hamilton could not deliver the votes to assure Pennsylvania's victory in the residency sweepstakes. Third, and most significantly, delegates from Virginia and Pennsylvania met on June 15th and agreed on a political alliance whereby Philadelphia would become the temporary capital and, a major triumph for the Virginians, the Potomac site was resurrected as the permanent residence, a compromise the Pennsylvania delegates probably accepted out of the conviction that, once the capital moved from New York to Philadelphia, it would never move again. Doubtless there were several additional dinners, clandestine meetings, and secret sessions that have escaped the historical record, but the ones we do know about demonstrate conclusively that the compromise reached over Jefferson's dinner table was really the final chapter in an ongoing negotiation that came together because the ground had already been prepared. More specifically, Jefferson's account of the dinner table conversation distorts the truth by conveniently eliminating the preliminary negotiations, thereby giving the story a more romantic gloss by implying that three prominent leaders could solve an apparently intractable national problem by establishing the proper atmospherics. The Potomac location for the permanent capital had, in fact, already been secured. Hamilton did not need to deliver any votes on that score, though there is some evidence he agreed to help seal the Potomac deal by urging his friends in New York and Massachusetts not to spoil it. Madison did need to come up with at least three votes on assumption. Here, Jefferson's account is accurate, and eventually four members switched their votes, all of them congressmen from districts bordering on the Potomac. The major business of the evening, in all likelihood, was an agreement to recalculate Virginia's debt and corresponding share of the enlarged federal debt. In effect, Madison got what he had always demanded, settlement before assumption, and Hamilton did what he had unofficially implied he would do all along, manipulate the numbers to make the Virginians more comfortable with assumption. This last dimension of the deal was not terribly attractive, so Jefferson left it out of his account altogether. But he immediately sent out letters to his Virginia friends, confiding that the new version of the assumption bill would reduce the state's total obligation so that the debt assumed and the federal taxes owed would turn out, rather miraculously, exactly equal. $3.5 million. "Being, therefore, to receive exactly what she is to pay," he observed triumphantly, "she will neither win nor lose by the measure. Assumption, in effect, would be a wash. The total financial package, moreover, once the Potomac location was factored into the equations, should make most Virginians smile. For the proximity of the new capital, Jefferson predicted, will vivify our agriculture and commerce by circulating through our state an additional sum every year of $500,000. Jefferson was only guessing, of course, and the larger significance of the Potomac site transcended any merely economic forecast. But his initial gloss on the bargain had substantive merit. It was a three-sided deal: residence, revised assumption, and settlement, and Virginia won on each score. But would the bargain actually hold? Jefferson and Madison made their greatest contribution not during the dinner itself, but in the months afterward, when they assured that the answer to that question remained resolutely positive. The sudden victory of the Potomac location had surprised almost everybody, since it had fallen to the bottom of the list in the spring of 1790, then somehow bobbed to the top again without any congressional debate. As a result, despite the passage of the residency bill in July, there was a widespread skepticism about a capital, as one New York wag put it, where the houses and kitchens are yet to be framed, the trees to be felled, and the streets to be named. The Philadelphia press was particularly incredulous, declaring that it was abhorrent to common sense to suppose they are to have a place dug out of the rocky wilderness for the use of Congress only 4 months in the year, and all the rest of the time to be inhabited by wild beasts. The consensus in Congress was clear that, once ensconced in Philadelphia, the capital would never move to some deserted and wholly hypothetical place. "It will be generally viewed as a mere political maneuver," observed one congressman. "You might as well induce a belief that you are in earnest by inserting Mississippi, Detroit, or Winnipeg Pocket Pond as Conococheague." The strategy that Jefferson and Madison adopted was elegantly effective and thoroughly imperialistic. One senses Madison's matchless political savvy at work throughout the process, but also a preview of Jefferson's defiantly bold behavior 13 years later in pushing through the Louisiana Purchase. The key strategic insight was that the residency question must never again be allowed to come before Congress, where it was certain to fall victim to the political version of death by 1,000 cuts. Jefferson was particularly clear on this point. If the present occasion of securing the federal seat on the Potomac should be lost, it could never more be regained, and therefore it would be dangerous to rely on any aids from Congress or the assemblies of Virginia or Maryland, and that therefore measures should be adopted to carry the residence bill into execution without recourse to those bodies. But how could one do that, since the funds to purchase the land, the selection of the specific site, the appointment of an architect, and a host of unforeseeable but inevitable practicalities would seem to require legislative approval? The answer recalled the earliest advice, half-jokingly offered by a newspaper editor when the residency question had first appeared on the national agenda. Give the decision to George Washington. Jefferson proposed in August of 1790 that the entire series of subsequent decisions about the location, size, and shape of the capital be made a matter of executive discretion, that is, subject to the president's direction in every point. While congressmen continued to make sarcastic jokes about the uncertain location of the theoretical Potomac site, why not put the new capital on wheels and roll it from place to place? Jefferson and Madison were tramping up and down the Maryland and Virginia countryside assessing the terrain. Washington listened to their report, then made the decision in January of 1791, the 100-square-mile area stretching east from Georgetown to the mouth of the Potomac. Jefferson noticed that Washington seemed unusually reticent about his choice, probably because Mount Vernon adjoined the site and Washington also owned considerable acreage within its borders. He might also have felt somewhat uncomfortable knowing that this easternmost option contradicted the impression that Madison had created in the earlier debates, namely that a more western location near the Pennsylvania border was preferred. The Pennsylvanians, who had conceded the Potomac choice on the presumption of its proximity, were surely disappointed. Perhaps naming the central street in the new capital Pennsylvania Avenue was Washington's gesture of accommodation. At any rate, the decision was made, and it was final. And no one in America was prepared to question a decision made by Washington, at least publicly, when rendered so summarily. Every step in the decade-long process of designing and building the city predestined to carry his name was supervised by Washington. Like a military operation, it had many troops, but only one commander. In late fall of 1790, Jefferson wrote Washington about the political urgency of starting construction as soon as possible. Mr. Madison and myself have endeavored to press the expediency of their undertaking to build 10 good private dwellings a year for 10 years in the new city. Should they do this, it will be one means of ensuring the removal of government thither. Once the buildings were up, in other words, Philadelphia's hopes would collapse. In a speech delivered as the residency bill was being passed in the House, Madison had noted that many observers fully expected the Potomac choice to be repealed and the capital to remain at Philadelphia. "But what more can we do than pass a law for this purpose?" he asked rhetorically, "since a repeal is a thing against which no provision can be made." Then he concluded, "But I flatter myself that some respect will be paid to the public interest and to the plighted faith of the government. By making the implementation an executive action headed by Washington, Jefferson and Madison demonstrated that, plighted faith notwithstanding, they were taking no chances. On the other side of the dinner table bargain, however, they had already taken a calculated risk by betting that more favorable financial terms, plus the capture of the permanent capital, would undermine Virginia's powerful aversion to assumption. Several friends south of the Potomac had warned them that the widespread hostility toward Hamilton's financial plan defied compromise of any sort. The assumption, under any modification, will, I fear, be considered as a bitter pill in this state, ran one typical account, and arguments of accommodation will have but little avail. The old anti-Federalist coalition that Madison had opposed so effectively at the Virginia Ratifying Convention in 1788 believed with some justification that their cause had never really been defeated, merely outmaneuvered. Under the renewed leadership of Patrick Henry, with an able assist from Henry Lee, this powerful group mobilized against Assumption in the fall of 1790 and pushed a resolution through both branches of the Virginia legislature in December. It brought together the old revolutionary rhetoric, even deploying some familiar Jeffersonian language with all the oppositional energy of the Whig tradition, then hurled it at Assumption as the new incarnation of foreign domination. Like the previous attempts by Parliament, Assumption was described as a threat to Virginia's independence and a measure which must, in the course of human events, produce one or other of two evils, the prostration of agriculture at the feet of commerce, or a change in the present form of federal government fatal to the existence of American liberty. As Jefferson and Madison arrived in Philadelphia for the first session of Congress in the new but merely temporary capital, the newspapers were filled with caustic commentary on the defiant tone of the Virginia resolution. The resolution of the Virginia Assembly respecting the assumption of the state debts exhibits a very curious phenomenon in the history of the United States. The majority who voted in favor of the resolution, it seems, fell asleep in September 1787, just before the rising of the Federal Convention, and did not awake till a few weeks ago, during which time the federal government was adopted and established throughout all the states. Their vote, therefore, must be ascribed to ignorance of what passed during their long sleep. The resolution is calculated only for those years of anarchy which preceded the general ratification of the present happy national government. It is now nugatory and ridiculous. Hamilton also took note of the implicit secessionist threat contained in Virginia's statement. It was, he warned, the first symptom of a spirit which must either be killed or will kill the Constitution of the United States. Back in September of 1787, just as the Constitutional Convention was completing its business, Hamilton had made a prediction. The newly created federal government would either triumph altogether over the state governments and reduce them to an entire subordination, he surmised, or, in the course of a few years, the contests about the boundaries of power between the particular governments and the general government will produce a dissolution of the Union. Virginia's posture toward Assumption was now making his prophecy look prescient. Hamilton shared his ominous sense of the situation with John Jay, his part-time collaborator as Publius in the Federalist Papers. But he said nothing to Madison, his full-time collaborator, since it was no longer clear where Madison stood. Was he a Virginian or an American? Did he think the truly founding moment for the new nation was 1776 or 1787? These dramatic questions, as much as the location of the capital on the Potomac, were the residual legacies of the dinner at Jefferson's. For the next 70 years, until the outbreak of the Civil War in 1861, the essence of political wisdom in the emergent American Republic was to insist that such choices did not have to be made. But the recognition that these were the competing options, the contested versions, if you will, of what the core legacy of the American Revolution truly meant, first became visible in the summer of 1790. The Constitution did not resolve these questions. It only provided an orderly framework within which the arguments could continue. Nor would it be historically correct to regard the issues at stake as exclusively or even primarily constitutional. Legalistic debates over federal versus state sovereignty were just the most accessible handles to grab, the safest and most politically suitable ways to talk about alternative national visions. The Compromise of 1790 is most famous for averting a political crisis that many statesmen of the time considered a threat to the survival of the infant republic. But it also exposed the incompatible expectations concerning America's future that animated these same statesmen. In a sense, it is a very old story, which has been rendered even more familiar by the violent dissolution of revolutionary regimes in modern-day emergent nations. Bound together in solidarity against the imperialistic enemy, the leadership fragments when the common enemy disappears, and the different agenda for the new nation must confront its differences. Securing a revolution has proven to be a much more daunting assignment than winning one. The accommodation that culminated in the agreement reached over Jefferson's dinner table provides a momentary exposure of the sharp differences dividing the leadership of the revolutionary generation. Sectional versus national allegiance, agrarian versus commercial economic priorities, diffusion versus consolidation as social ideals, an impotent versus a potent federal government. The compromise reached did not resolve these conflicts so much as prevent them from exploding when the newly created government was so vulnerable. It bought time during which the debate could continue. Thanks to the efforts of Jefferson and Madison, the ongoing debate would have a decidedly Southern accent. In some vaguely general fashion, they understood this, regarding the construction of the District of Columbia on the Potomac as a statement of Virginia's enduring influence over the federal government. Although the Virginia writ large view of the United States they harbored had an arrogant and provincial odor about it, their presumptions did reflect certain demographic and economic realities. Virginia contained 1/5 of the nation's total population and generated 1/3 of its commerce. What's more, as John Adams so nicely put it, in Virginia all geese are swans, meaning that Virginia's elite genuinely believed that it had almost single-handedly launched and led the war for independence. The Old Dominion was accustomed to thinking of itself as primus inter pares in any confederation of states. The geographic location of the new capital played to these pretensions by making it the physical projection of Virginia. It did not matter so much that the Virginia writ large vision was mostly an illusion. It was a deeply felt illusion that the location of the new capital somewhat appeased. Although it never seemed to be part of the conscious intention of either Jefferson or Madison at the time, the isolated location and de novo character of the national capital had even deeper political implications. For at the start and for several decades thereafter, it remained a vast and nearly vacant plot of ground. Visitors in those early years who stopped to ask directions to the American capital were often astonished when told they were standing squarely in its center. Anyone apprehensive about the encroaching powers of the federal government must have felt a palpable sense of reassurance that the seat of power was virtually invisible. or if, like Jefferson, one believed that cities were sores on the body politic and agrarian values were the mainstay of American virtue, then Washington, D.C. must have seemed the perfect capital for the new republic, since it was really not a city at all. If the clustering together or consolidation of political power touched some primal nerve, conjuring up horrific scenes of courtiers in London or Paris plotting against the rights of ordinary citizens, again the American capital performed visual therapy by lacking courts, corridors, or many public buildings whatsoever. It symbolized the victory of diffusion over consolidation. Nor were Hamilton's dreaded money men likely to find it a particularly hospitable environment. The pervasive emptiness and stultifying summer heat were only minor deterrents when compared with the more elemental consideration that all the banking and commercial institutions were based elsewhere, chiefly in Philadelphia and New York. By selecting the Potomac location, the Congress had implicitly decided to separate the political and financial capitals of the United States. All the major European capitals, Berlin, London, Paris, Rome, Vienna, were metropolitan centers that gathered together the political, economic, and cultural energies of their respective populations in one place. The United States was almost inadvertently deciding to segregate them. The exciting synergy of institutional life in an all-purpose national metropolis was deemed less important than the dangerous corruptions likely to afflict a nexus of politicians and financiers. And so, while Hamilton and his followers could claim that the compromise permitted the core features of his financial plan to win approval, which in turn meant the institutionalization of fiscal reforms with centralizing implications that would prove very difficult to dislodge, the permanent residents of the capital on the Potomac institutionalized political values designed to carry the nation in a fundamentally different direction. It was also symbolic in a personal sense for Jefferson and Madison, for the Compromise of 1790 signaled the resumption of their political partnership after 5 years of separation. Now the great collaboration was truly an alliance worthy of its name. Many of their closest friends and colleagues in Virginia had urged them to regard Hamilton's program as clinching evidence of a foreign takeover of the national government that fully justified a withdrawal from the Union. Jefferson and Madison claimed to share their apprehensions and their political principles, but not their secessionist impulses. Their strategy was different. They would not abandon the government, but capture it. Like the new capital, it would become an extension of Virginia, or at least the Virginia vision of what the American Revolution meant, and the American Republic was therefore meant to be. Jefferson would oversee and orchestrate this campaign and provide its rhetorical foundation, which enjoyed a privileged association with the spirit of 76. Madison would actually lead the troops and do the necessary political infighting. Though it would not be easy, and would take the remainder of the decade to accomplish, that is pretty much what happened. Chapter 3. The Silence. Just a few months before Jefferson staged his historic dinner party, something happened in the Congress of the United States that no one had anticipated. Indeed, most of the political leadership considered it an embarrassing intrusion. On February 11, 1790, two Quaker delegations, one from New York and the other from Philadelphia, presented petitions to the House calling for the federal government to put an immediate end to the African slave trade. This was considered an awkward interruption, disrupting as it did the critical debate over the assumption and residency questions, with an inflammatory proposal that several Southern representatives immediately denounced as mischievous meddling. Representative James Jackson from Georgia was positively apoplectic that such a petition would even be considered by any serious deliberative body. The Quakers, he argued, were infamous innocents, incessantly disposed to drip their precious purity like holy water over everyone else's sins. They were also highly questionable patriots, having sat out the recent war against British tyranny in deference to their cherished consciences. What standing could such dedicated pacifists enjoy among veterans of the Revolution, who, as Jackson put it, at the risk of their lives and fortunes, secured to the community their liberty and property? William Loughton Smith from South Carolina rose to second Jackson's objection. The problematic patriotism of the Quaker petitioners was, Smith agreed, reprehensible. But his colleague from Georgia need not dally over the credentials of these pathetic eccentrics. The Constitution of the United States, only recently ratified, specifically prohibited the Congress from passing any law that abolished or restricted the slave trade until 1808. Article 1, Section 9, Paragraph 1 read, "The migration or importation of such persons as any of the states now existing shall think proper to admit shall not be prohibited by the Congress prior to the year 1808. Several current members of Congress also happened to have served as delegates to the Constitutional Convention, and they could all testify that the document would never have been approved in Philadelphia or ratified by several of the southern states without this provision. Beyond these still warm memories, the language of the Constitution was unambiguous. The federal government could not tamper with the slave trade during the first 20 years of the nation's existence. The Quaker petitioners, therefore, were asking for something that had already been declared unavailable. Jackson, however, was not about to be consoled by constitutional protections. He detected even more sinister motives behind the benign smiles of the misnamed Society of Friends. "I apprehend, if through the interference of the general government the slave trade was abolished," he observed, "it would evince to the people a general disposition toward a total emancipation." In short, the Quaker petition for an end of the slave trade was really a stalking horse for a more radical and thoroughgoing scheme to end the institution of slavery itself. James Madison rose to assume his customary role as the vigilant voice of cool reason. His colleague from Georgia was overreacting. Indeed, his impassioned rhetoric, while doubtless sincere, was both misguided and counterproductive. The Quaker petition should be heard and forwarded to a committee as a matter of course. If, in other words, the matter were treated routinely and with a minimum of fuss, it would quickly evaporate. As Madison put it, no notice would be taken it out of doors. On the other hand, Jackson's own overwrought opposition, much like air bursts in a night battle, actually called attention to the issues the Quakers wished to raise. If Jackson would only restrain himself, the petition would go away and never be blown up into a decision of the question respecting the discouragement of the African slave trade, nor alarm the owners with an apprehension that the general government were about to abolish slavery in all the states. For, as Madison assured Jackson, such things are not contemplated by any gentleman in the Congress. The next day, however, on February 12th, Jackson's fearful prophecies seemed to be coming true, for on that day another petition arrived in the House, this one from the Pennsylvania Abolition Society. It urged the Congress to take such measures in their wisdom as the powers with which they are invested will authorize for promoting the abolition of slavery and discouraging every species of traffic in slaves. Just as Jackson had warned, opposition to the slave trade was now being linked to ending slavery altogether. What's more, this new petition made two additional points calculated to exacerbate the fears of men like Jackson. First, it claimed that both slavery and the slave trade were incompatible with the values for which the American Revolution had been fought, and it even instructed the Congress on its political obligation to devise means for removing this inconsistency from the character of the American people. Second, it challenged the claim that the Constitution prohibited any legislation by the federal government against the slave trade for 20 years, suggesting instead that the General Welfare Clause of the Constitution empowered the Congress to take whatever action it deemed necessary and proper to eliminate the stigma of traffic in human beings and to countenance the restoration of liberty for all Negroes. Finally, to top it all off and heighten its dramatic appeal, the petition arrived under the signature of Benjamin Franklin, whose patriotic credentials and international reputation were beyond dispute. Indeed, if there were an American pantheon, only Washington would have had a more secure place in it than Franklin. Franklin's endorsement of the petition from the Pennsylvania Abolition Society effectively assured that the preferred Madisonian strategy, calmly receiving these requests, then banishing them to the congressional version of oblivion, was not going to work. In fact, the ongoing debate on the assumption and residency questions was set aside for the entire day, as the House put itself into committee of the whole to permit unencumbered debate on the petitions. During the course of that debate, which lasted between 4 and 6 hours, things were said that had never before been uttered in any public forum at the national level. Granted, the delegates to the Constitutional Convention had engaged in extensive debates about the slave trade and how to count slaves for the purposes of representation and taxation. But these debates had all occurred behind closed doors and under the strictest code of confidentiality. Madison's informal record of these debates, the fullest account, was not published in his lifetime. Granted also that the place of slavery in the new national order had come up in several state ratifying conventions in 1788. But these state-based deliberations quite naturally tended to focus on local or regional interpretations of the Constitution's rather elliptical handling of the forbidden subject. No specific mention of slavery, slaves, or Negroes had been permitted into the final draft of the document. If political leaders who had pushed through the constitutional settlement of 1787 to 1788 had been permitted to speak, their somewhat awkward conclusion would have been that slavery was too important and controversial a subject to talk about publicly. This explains the initial reaction of several representatives from South Carolina who objected to the suggestion that the petitions should be read aloud in the halls of Congress. Adonis Burke, for example, warned that the petitioners were blowing the trumpet of sedition and demanded that the galleries be cleared of all spectators and newspaper reporters. Jackson also heard trumpets blowing, though for him they were trumpets of civil war. The position of all the speakers from the Deep South seemed to be that the Constitution not only prohibited the Congress from legislating about slavery or the slave trade, it forbade anyone in Congress from even mentioning those subjects publicly. If this was their position, events quickly demonstrated that it was an argument they were destined to lose. The debate began when Thomas Scott of Pennsylvania, speaking on behalf of the petitioners, acknowledged that the Constitution imposed restrictions on Congress's power to end the slave trade, but said nothing whatsoever about abolishing slavery itself. As Scott put it, "If I was one of the judges of the United States, I do not know how far I might go if these people were to come before me and claim their emancipation. But I am sure I would go as far as I could." Whereupon Jackson commented that any judge rendering such an opinion in Georgia would be of short duration. Jackson then launched into a sermon on God's will, which he described as patently pro-slavery based on several passages in the Bible and the pronouncements of every Christian minister in Georgia. Alongside the clear preferences of the Almighty, there was the nearly unanimous opinion of every respectable citizen in his state, whose livelihood depended on the availability of slave labor, and who shared the elemental recognition, as Jackson put it, that rice cannot be brought to market without these people. William Loudon Smith preferred to leave the interpretation of God's will to others, but he seconded the opinion of his colleague from Georgia that slavery was an economic precondition for the prosperity of his constituents, noting that such is the state of agriculture in that country, no white man would perform the tasks required to drain the swamps and clear the land so that, without slaves, it must be depopulated. Smith also led the debate on behalf of the Deep South on that other great text, which was not the Bible, but the Constitution. In Smith's version of the story, the framers of the Constitution had recognized that the chief source of conflict among the state delegations was between those dependent on slave labor and those free of such dependency. A sectional understanding had emerged whereby northern states had agreed not to tamper with the property rights of southern states. In addition to the specific provisions of the Constitution, which recognized the slave population as worthy of at least some measure of representation in Congress, and the protection of the slave trade for at least another 20 years after ratification, there was also an implicit but broadly shared understanding that the newly created federal government could do nothing to interfere with the existence of slavery in the South. All the southern states had ratified the Constitution with that understanding as a primal precondition. Upon that reason, they acceded to the Constitution, Smith declared. Unless that part was granted, they would not have come into the Union. His evident distress at these Quaker petitions was rooted in his belief that the current debate represented a violation of that understanding. Representative Abraham Baldwin of Georgia chimed in to support Smith's version of the federal compact. Gentlemen who had been present at the formation of this Constitution, Baldwin himself had been one such gentleman, could not avoid the recollection of the pain and difficulty which the subject caused in that body. The essential agreement reached in Philadelphia in 1787, Baldwin claimed, was the decision to remove slavery in the southern states from any influence by the northern states. If gentlemen look over the footsteps of that body, Baldwin observed, they will find the greatest degree of caution used to imprint them so as not to be easily eradicated. Any attempt to renegotiate that sectional agreement by the current Congress would result in the disintegration of the National Confederation at the very moment of its birth. Several Northern representatives rose to contest the claim that both the Bible and the Constitution endorsed slavery. John Lawrence of New York wondered how any Christian could read the Sermon on the Mount and believe it was compatible with chattel slavery. As far as the Constitution was concerned, Lawrence acknowledged that certain provisions recognized the existence of slavery and provided temporary protection for those states wishing to import more Africans. But the larger understanding, as Lawrence saw it, was that slavery was an anomaly in the American Republic, a condition that could be tolerated in the short run precisely because there was a clear consensus that it would be ended in the long run. Scott of Pennsylvania echoed those sentiments, suggesting that the defining text was not the Constitution, but the Declaration of Independence, which clearly announced that it was not possible that one man should have property in person of another. Elbridge Gerry of Massachusetts attempted to offer conciliatory words to his southern colleagues, though he did so in a decidedly northern accent. His rambling remarks described the predicament of slave owners as truly tragic and not of their own making. They had been betrayed into the slave trade by the first settlers. But rather than countenance their unfortunate condition, the chief task of those northern states spared the same fate should be to rescue them from it. This was both a political obligation and a matter of humanity toward both the slaves and those who owned them. The Quaker petitions were therefore not treasonable or out of order. They were as worthy as anything that can come before the House. Jerry then presented his own personal estimate of the revenue required to compensate the slave owners for purchasing their slaves at current market value, and came up with the figure of $10 million. How he derived this amount was murky. It was much lower than any realistic estimate. But his thinking about the source for the revenue was clear. Voters would not accept a tax sufficient to cover these costs, so the only plausible course would be to establish a national fund for this purpose, created out of the profits from the sale of Western lands. As for the slave trade, the sooner that despicable traffic was ended, the better for everybody. Although the sectional battle lines were clearly drawn in the debate, the position of the Virginia delegation was equivocal. Representative John Page, for example, seemed to offer one of the most ringing endorsements of the petitions. He warned his colleagues from the Deep South that their opposition to the mere mention of an end to slavery and the slave trade was misguided. The real threat was silence. But then Page explained his thinking, which went like this. Reports of this debate would eventually find their way into the slave quarters of the South, and when the slaves learned that Congress would not even consider ways to mitigate their condition or end their misery, they would have no hope. The consequence would be slave insurrections, for if anything could induce him, a slave, to rebel, it must be a stroke like this. Madison's thinking was decidedly less eccentric, although still problematic. As befitted the central player in the Constitutional Convention, Madison emphasized the various legal obligations imposed by the Compact of 1787. While he thought the Constitution was crystal clear that Congress could not restrict or terminate the slave trade before 1808, it did not prohibit the members of the House from talking about the issue. They could talk about anything they wished, including the gradual abolition of slavery itself, though he felt that Congress was unlikely to take any dramatic action tending to the emancipation of the slave.